You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. CBS News reported earlier this week that government documents marked classified had been found at the Penn Biden Center, where President Biden had had an office for several years, including after his term as vice president. We've since learned about additional documents that turned up in Biden's private residence in Delaware. Yesterday, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the Justice Department would be looking into all of it.
I strongly believe that the normal processes of this department can handle all investigations with integrity. But under the regulations, the extraordinary circumstances here require the appointment of a special counsel for this matter. This appointment underscores for the public the department's commitment to both independence and accountability in particularly sensitive matters, and to making decisions indisputably guided only by the facts and the law.
That special counsel will focus on the Biden document story. There's already another special counsel focused in part on former President Trump's removal of classified documents. The House Judiciary Committee announced today that it would conduct oversight of this special counsel investigation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about all of this? What is similar? What is different between the investigations into classified documents regarding current President Biden, former President Trump? What's your reaction to all of this? Do you think we need to change the way we handle these documents in the first place? What do you think about the appointment of a special counsel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you to the listeners for tuning in.
Can you share your thoughts, first of all, on the appointment of a special counsel by the Attorney General to investigate these documents?
It's probably necessary at this point, given the fact that there's a special counsel who was also appointed to do investigations regarding Donald Trump on a variety of matters, and given the fact that the Attorney General is now being asked to investigate his boss, you really need a process set up to take it away from him and have somebody independent do this. There's a broader discussion probably to have about the fact that post-Watergate, we did have a special prosecutor law in place permanently to address these issues, and it expired in the 1990s. And we may want to have a larger discussion at some point regarding the desirability of bringing such a law back in terms of not having it ad hoc like it is here. But I think given the difficulty of potential, and I say potential violations of the law within the executive branch, an independent counsel is necessary here.
Yeah, the Attorney General is this weird kind of ambiguous position. They're a cabinet appointee of the president, confirmed by the Senate. They're in the chain of command with the president at the top of it, but they're supposed to be independent too and able to investigate the current executive branch, among other things. Does that create a natural tension there?
It does create a natural tension. And what also makes it more complicated here is that the person who's the Attorney General, besides reporting to the president, is supposed to represent the United States of America, representing, you know, the government. But at the same time, in some situations, the Attorney General provides, let's say, some legal advice to the president, not the president's personal legal counsel, but provides counsel. And so this creates a series of conflicts of interest and difficulties in terms of sorting them out. So the idea of creating a special counsel is to try to address this issue. One can sort of argue that one of the things that maybe our constitutional framers missed, you know, back in 1787 in drafting the Constitution is how do we go about policing the executive branch, which is entrusted to enforce the law, if there's allegations that somebody, including the president, has violated the law? This is a problem for us.
Before we get into the particulars of these documents, you mentioned to our producer, we should first talk about the Presidential Papers Act. Why is that an important first step?
Okay, so the Presidential Papers Act was adopted, I believe, in 1980, 1981, and it's a really simple concept that says that the papers of the President of the United States do not belong to the President of the United States in terms of official government documents. That while the president is president, Obviously, they produce lots of documents, lots of memos and so forth like that. But when that person leaves office, they do not get to take the government documents with them. They are supposed to be deposited with the National Archives for posterity, for future history. And the reason why I mention this is that across the board, whether we're talking about Donald Trump, whether we're talking about Joe Biden, or take us back to 2016 regarding allegations against Secretary Clinton and emails, at the end of the day, these papers, these communications are supposed to belong to the president, or rather belong to the National Archives, and should not be treated as personal property. So the question becomes, for our purposes with Trump and with Biden, how did these papers get into their personal possession? And then what should we be doing about it? And how have the two of them responded in terms of returning these materials back to the United States and to the archives?
Talking to David Schultz, political scientist at Hamline University, law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at presidential documents. The news this week that when he left the White House as vice president, Joe Biden ended up with some of these classified documents in an office and at his personal residence. This follows the long-running story of former President Trump taking documents with him. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And with these documents in Biden's apparent possession, David, we don't have a ton of details. What do we know that you see as significant?
Well, what we know at this point, it seems to be a small number, although I think a story later today seems to be increasing the number. And what we seem to know in terms of a contrast here is that when Trump left the White House, he took an undisclosed number, although we now think it's about several hundred documents, some of them classified, some of them top secret, to the Mar-a-Lago. They were not safely stored. And then when requested by the Justice Department to return them, there was an initial denial that they had anything. Eventually, the Justice Department had to secure a search warrant to go get these documents. In the case of Joe Biden, right now it seems like it's a more limited number of documents that Biden has discovered and is now turning over and cooperating with the Justice Department. And this seems to be, I think, an important factual difference between the two in terms of how both Trump and Biden are approaching these documents and how they're responding to complying with the presidential papers law.
Now, I mentioned the House Judiciary Committee looking at an investigation into the Biden documents. On the one hand, you might say, okay, yeah, of course, Republicans in the House, they're going to want to go after a Democrat in the White House. On the other hand, this is part of what Congress is supposed to do, right? This is their role to provide oversight over the executive branch.
You're absolutely correct. And there is if we cut through some of the partisanship, there is a bigger concern here, is the fact that we now have a former vice president who's now president and a former president who have in possession documents that they're not supposed to have at this point. And I think Congress should legitimately figure out, do we need to change the law? Do we need to strengthen it? You know, what are some different protocols that are in place to make sure that these documents don't slip out? To the best of our knowledge, neither the documents in Biden's possession nor Trump's possession, to the best of our knowledge, have compromised, let's say, national security or anything critical. But that's a legitimate concern for Congress to think about. And just for people, I want to put a perspective in here, is for those people who are listeners who have served in the military, for example, they would know that any classified material, they have to guard very cautiously. And for any of us who've ever worked from home, where we want to, like, you know, access files from home or take files home, most of us know that there's all types of protocols in place to protect a company's secrets. We should think of the same issue here. How does Congress, in its legitimate oversight functions, ensure that we do not compromise national security or confidential information? And that's a legitimate job for this Congress to look at.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hi.
I'm sorry that this happened to Biden. I don't know if there's something wrong with the system of keeping track of those top secret papers, but the thing I really wanted to talk about is how the Republicans were so quiet during this whole thing with Trump, and Trump was fighting it tooth and nail and not responding, and that they had to go in with the FBI and a search warrant. The Republicans didn't say anything other than the FBI was being weaponized. But now, suddenly, when they find Biden has these papers, they're all over it with investigations, with assessments, and with the special counsel. I just get kind of annoyed at that. Maybe that's a sign that we really do have a broken government.
Rick, thanks for the call. Just one clarification. I've seen classified, the word used to describe these documents in Biden's possession. I don't know that I've seen top secret yet, David. But to Rick's wider point, the varying partisan response to these two different instances.
I think he's absolutely correct here, is that we are seeing on both sides very different partisan responses. For the Democrats, when it was Trump, it was like, go get him. Again, Republicans seem to be like, you know, this is what? This is just harassing a former president. Now the shoe is on the other foot. And what I'm trying to sort of argue here is the fact that we've got a broader principle at stake here, a broader concern about that we have a law in place that says these documents are to be protected. Former presidents, former vice presidents do not get to leave the job taking these documents with them. We need to figure out, are there better protocols in place, better procedures to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future? Again, it doesn't look like in either situations that national security was compromised, as far as we know, or that secrets got out to the enemy. But there may be things that we need to do to make sure this doesn't happen in the future. And even if we assume for the sake of argument that both Trump and Biden were, let's say, benign, their motives were not harmful, there still appears to be a problem here we need to address.
Rick, thanks for that call. We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the government documents marked classified that have turned up in an office used by President Joe Biden, as well as Biden's private residence in Delaware, apparently stemming from his departure from the White House after his term as vice president. Also, comparisons and contrasts with former President Trump and his document story. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about this new special counsel investigation, the one applied to former President Trump as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the special counsel appointment to look at classified documents in an office used by now President Biden after his term as vice president and at his residence, and comparisons with the Trump classified document investigation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. As much as I believe there is a difference between the former president and the current one, both of them have actually broken the law, and both of them are disqualified from running for office.
John, thanks for the call. Both, he says, broke the law. He was breaking up a little bit there and should be disqualified, John says, from running for office. What do you think?
Well, at this point, it does look like both of them have broken the law. Now, when I say broken the law, we have to, obviously the law, if they did something, it looks like they're wrong. Whether or not they're criminally culpable, that's what the whole purpose of the special investigators or special prosecutors are for. In terms of whether they should be disqualified for running for office in the future, that probably becomes a question for the public to decide at this point, you know, that how do you put this into the mix in terms of thinking about as potential nominees for 2024? I'll pass on answering that question. I think that's the choice of the American public.
John, thanks for that call. Jim joins us now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Nothing but season base.
Oh, you there, Hello? Jim? Yeah, yes. You're on the air, Jim. Go for it.
It's my understanding that anybody who takes secure documents out of the appropriate location is breaking the law, whether they're vice president or whatever, except that a president can declassify documents at his will, and there is no legal procedure or proof needed. I haven't seen any evidence that he did not declassify documents that he had. Until we know what the contents of these documents are, we can't know whether they might have been taken because they were incriminating and the person didn't want them available. We need to know what the documents were about.
Jim, thanks for the call. A couple points there. The idea that, yeah, if you were that person in the military you mentioned earlier, David, or a contractor or whatever, you might well face consequences in terms of losing your job or going to jail. Are things different for a president or a vice president?
No, they are not, actually. And there's been a lot of talk out there saying, well, presidents can just on their own just declassify documents. And the answer is not really, is that there is a established procedure that must be followed both to classify documents in terms of classified, secret, top secret, et cetera, like that. But at the same time, if a president wants to, let us say, I'll just make up an example here. We wanted for some reason to make public information regarding, let's say, our nuclear fleet or something like that. A president just can't say, here's the information. There is a set of protocols and rules for declassifying. I know there's at one point Donald Trump made some kind of argument that said he can just sort of, you know, declassify by, what is it, by his mind or something like that? I can't remember what his phrase was. The answer is no. There's our system has rules in place to how to do this. And presidents, too, would be held accountable or should be held accountable if they release information that's supposed to be classified without following the proper procedures.
Thanks for the call. Josh joins us now in Waukesha. John, hi.
Oh, it'd be Josh in Waukesha.
Oh, Josh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Don't have my glasses on.
It's my understanding that as president, he has the authority to be in charge of these documents, and also that the FBI was aware that Trump was in possession of these documents, and even just simply told him to put a lock on them, and they had access to them prior to the raid, and he had the right and authority to have those as president. But Biden, as vice president, did not have that same governmental authority over these documents that a president would have. So, and I just have to disagree that the president doesn't have authority over documents that he sees as necessary for him to have access to or decide where and when he is storing those documents. I don't understand how.
Got it. Josh, thanks for calling in. I had thought that too, David, the president-vice president thing, but there was a 2009 Obama-era executive order that does give a vice president the power to declassify documents while they're in office. So, but the fact is, like, it doesn't seem like they went through the process in either case to declassify these.
Correct. Absolutely correct. I think the point is, is exactly the point I was trying to make there, is that a president or vice president does have control of the documents, but if they want to declassify, they have to go through a process. But just sort of added up here also, too, is that once they're no longer president, once they're no longer vice president, they have no authority whatsoever to either have these documents in their possession or to try to take any action to declassify them. Because what? They're no longer in power. So those are critical things to point out here. Yes, perhaps while Trump was president, maybe it's okay for him to have the documents at Mar-a-Lago where he was working. But clearly, once he's no longer president, he shouldn't have those possession. But this does raise a bigger question, is that if presidents are going to be working somewhere else, and this is my analogy to us working at home, if we're working at home, most of, as far as I know, our companies are going to have protocols for how we protect any trade secrets, how we access files, et cetera, et cetera. We may be thinking about a question of saying, should we allow presidents to be able to move classified documents to non-secure locations such as private residences or vacation places? I think this is part of what the investigations with Congress need to address.
I want to take a minute or so to look at the appointee as special counsel to investigate the documents that had been in Biden's possession. This is Robert Hur. He'd been a Maryland U.S. attorney. He was a Trump appointee to that post and served in the Trump White House. What do you think of the politics and the image of that choice?
I think they had to do something like that. I think it's a good choice, by the way. He's got a clean reputation, as far as I know. And the fact that you're having somebody who was appointed by the previous president, I think should take some of the concern out with some people thinking, well, it's just a Democrat with a Democratic attorney general hiring a Democratic prosecutor. The fact that they're going to give independence to a Trump-appointed person certainly isn't going to assuage all critics, but I think it moves in a good direction.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you to the listeners.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We talked to him today about the developing story of government documents that had been marked classified that were found in an office and then a residence of President Joe Biden, and how the facts of that story compare and contrast with a similar one surrounding former President Donald Trump. Keep watching at WPR.org. We'll keep sharing reporting from NPR as that story develops. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a recent breakthrough in fusion energy could also give us new insights into what's going on inside of stars. An astrophysicist joins the show to share the mysteries of fusion in our sun and beyond. We'll meet the new Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources for a look at top priorities in the new year, including ongoing concerns about PFAS chemicals in water supplies, plus the possibility of limited medical marijuana laws here in Wisconsin. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we take the 7-day happiness challenge, which asks us to take little steps to make our relationships and our social networks stronger. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, the author of a new cookbook shares the secrets to making totally not boring salads of all shapes, sizes, colors, and flavors. First, if you want to be happier in 2023, we've got some advice. The longest running study on happiness going back to 1938 has found that the single most important thing for a happy life is relationships. Relationships are more important than wealth, IQ, or social status. So what can we do about it? Our next guest has a 7-day challenge for us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to strengthen your social connections this year? How do you plan on doing that? Do you feel like you're somebody who's really good at building and maintaining those interpersonal relationships? Or do you let them fall by the wayside like, well, some of us? I won't name any names. Me. Call 800-642-1234 with your experiences, with your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jancy Dunn is a columnist for the Well Desk at the New York Times. She recently wrote about ways to boost your relationships for better overall health. Jancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've heard this over the years that relationships, they're a big part of our happiness. I guess it kind of makes sense. But this long-running study going back to 1938 really hammers it home. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So, yes, it was from the Depression era. That's when it started. And it's called the Harvard Study of Adult Development. And it began in Boston. And it gradually, over the years, it mushroomed to three different generations. It grew to 1,300 people. And it was incredibly detailed. The researchers asked these, you know, they followed people throughout their lives and asked them very nosy questions. and they really did find that the key to happiness, the single decision that you could best ensure your own health and happiness, it was to cultivate warm relationships, and that's relationships of all kinds. It isn't just, you know, if you happen to have a partner or, you know, parents or your kids, it's everybody. It's friendships, which are very easy to neglect. You just kind of take your friends for granted. I do it too. And it's even what are called weak ties, people that you don't even know that well, that you maybe see their faces in your neighborhood. So it's every kind of relationship.
Well, the idea that we can do something about that, though, I think is super interesting, because we might think, I am who I am. I'm a people person, or I'm an introvert. I don't really, you know, form a lot of connections like that. We'll get to your challenge in a bit. But clearly, as you write in your piece, we do have some control over this.
Yes. And, you know, I wanted to make it very clear. And I had the author of the book, The Good Life, you know, on which we based this 7-day challenge, to reassure readers and anyone who wanted to participate that it is not just about being an extrovert. I know how hard it is. I'm an introvert. You would never know it because I've trained myself to present as an extrovert because I interview people all day long. But in fact, you know, I'm often dying inside when I'm talking to people. And so, you know, introverts, there's tons of research that they need social connections too. They just are different kinds of social connections. You know, everybody needs people. So it's not about, you know, turning yourself into an extrovert if that's not what you're about. And another anxiety that people had was, okay, well, how many friends do I need in order to be, you know, healthy and happy? There is not a number that you need. You know, if you have a couple of friends, but they're really sustained, wonderful relationships, great. It's not about being hung up about that. And yet another group of people, both in the study and with us, said, well, is it too late for me? And it's never too late. And you can start small and, you know, build your way up. But what I found about the research that was really interesting in all of us at the Well desk was that the authors introduced a concept called social fitness. And they say that you should incorporate social fitness into your fitness regimen the way you would exercise or nutrition or rest, that you have to think about your relationships and how you can maintain them for a healthier life. And I find that even if I have like an off week where I'm getting enough sleep and I'm, you know, being at least somewhat healthy, I think, oh, I know it's off. I haven't really talked to anybody that I that I care about. And that's an important part of this regimen.
Talking to Jan C. Dunn, columnist for The Well at the New York Times, getting a prescription, a challenge for happiness to boost our relationships in 7 easy steps. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you take active steps to stay in touch with that old friend, make new friends, make small talk with people who aren't friends at all, just people maybe around the neighborhood, at the store? These all help. These all work. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Before we go to our callers, Jancy, let's get into some of our steps here. And step one, day one of this challenge, is to assess our social fitness, our connections with people. Tell us a little bit about how we can do that.
Well, you know, it's just about looking around to see who's in your life and who, you know, there's all kinds of different relationships that you have. And they said that in the book as well, the researchers, that there's even different kinds of friendships, people that you go to for advice, people that can make you laugh, people that you can really tell your innermost secrets to. And so it was about kind of looking around and seeing what the different realms are and where you maybe could do a little better. It's not some sort of shaming exercise about like, oh, I don't have enough friends. It's more about, you know, everyone's craving connection. And we found that after COVID, right, that people just really missed being around other people. And so that's kind of what it's about. We have a quiz so you can kind of assess where you might crave a little bit more connection. And then we did some exercises from there.
And some of those exercises, now day two here, we know who maybe we want to, after doing the self-assessment, there's a little more to it than that. We might know who we want to start reconnecting with. I love this. Like I'm always like, okay, I'm going to be better this year. Really, really vague challenges like this. This is really concrete. 8-minute phone call. Tell us about the 8-minute phone call plan.
I know it's incredibly specific, isn't it? And we came up with that because we saw this research that people get really tense about when to end a phone call. There was one study that we cited that only 2% of people that were studied got off the phone at the same time. There's either the people that love to talk and talk and talk, like my father, or the people that rush you off the phone and there was just no good time. And there's even a social cue that there's other research about this. When people want to hang up, they say, "So anyway," and my mother, who's not a long talker, will say, "I'll let you go." And what that means is, please let me go. Right. And so there's this disparity in what people want. And there's already, especially among some younger generations, there's anxiety around phone calls. And so I said in a meeting, like I've been doing lately with some of my busy friends, how about 8 minutes? Because 5 minutes is too short. 10 minutes, there's the danger of it going 15 minutes, 20, 30, you know, that could be a problem. And then when we talked to Bob Waldinger, who wrote the book, The Good Life, he said, okay, I agree that 8 minutes is enough time to establish a real connection. And if you go in kind of in an intentional way, as funny as it sounds with the 8 minutes, I do understand how funny it sounds. You can, if you know you have a hard out, number one, takes away that anxiety. Number two, 8 minutes, dispense with small talk, get right into it. You can tackle a problem together. You can go over an issue, or you can update each other on what's going on. And then after the 8 minutes, I did one yesterday with my friend Lauren. You say, all right, see you. We'll talk soon. And that's the end of it. And you try to make a practice of doing it regularly. But what I do is I just text the people with whom I do this and say, like, okay, do you have time this week? Anytime? You know, it doesn't have to be this rigid thing. But people have really taken to it, including Jennifer Aniston. She reposted it on her Instagram stories. We were like, whoa. I mean, she's probably pretty busy, right? So she took to it. We got a little flutter of excitement from that one. So, yeah. So that's one of the exercises.
Yeah, 8 minutes isn't even long enough for a typical Midwestern goodbye, honestly. Like, well, let you get to it. Careful on the ice out there. You know, that kind of stuff. Let's bring
it up. Anyway, right. Yeah.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Carly is with us in Kewaunee. Carly, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just wondering opinions or advice. You know, we all have the friends that we, you know, don't talk to for a long time, and then we reconnect, and that's fine. We all, like, have that understanding because life's busy. But then I have a friend who, you know, me and another friend will constantly reach out. We all have kids the same age. Do you want to go here together? Let's try to get together this time. And she always has something to do. But then when she goes and does something fun, she doesn't reach out to us to join her. And then same with, like, text messages. Like, we'll be like, how's it going? This is what's going on in our lives. And she'll be like, oh, nothing. And, like, gives no detail, doesn't want to, you know. It's like, we know she's our friend, but she just puts zero effort into our friendship. So it's like, do we just continue to keep being like, do you want to be our friend? Can we, like, beg you to be our friend? Like, be our friend. And then
gotcha.
She just kind of hits back.
Carly, thanks for the call. I mean, that's not uncommon, I think, Jancy, the unrequited friendship. My suggestion would be, yeah, keep trying to reach out, but maybe don't focus all your friend energy there.
Yeah, I would say the exact same thing, because everybody has one of those elusive friends. And one of our exercises is to put a date on the calendar. And, you know, we've all been guilty of this, and we all have friends that do this where they'll say, oh, we have to get together sometime. And then it just sort of dies. But if you say, how about next Tuesday? Then you sort of, you know, at least try to pin them on it. But I agree with you. Like, at some point you have to direct your energies elsewhere, because the good thing about people is that there's lots of them. I mean, it's a nice resource to have, right? They're right in front of you, which is another thing that we liked about the challenge. Like, it's kind of unlimited.
Carly, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck. We're talking to New York Times columnist Jancy Dunn about ways to make our relationships and our social networks stronger, which it turns out is the best way to get happier, with 7 easy steps. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to make sure you have good, strong social connections, or lots of, like, nice, friendly social connections with people you're not even close to? That is also a good thing. Want to hear your friendship, maybe success stories, how you keep things going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And do you feel it? Do you feel like those social connections make you a happier person? We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with New York Times columnist Jancy Dunn about her 7-day happiness challenge. Every day of the challenge, there's a new way to make new social connections, strengthen the ones we've already got. It's the road to happiness. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own experiences, how you try to build and keep and maintain connections. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Burlington. Jeff, hi.
Hi, folks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm approaching 70, and after a career in real estate and local politics, I've found the best way to maintain a wide circle of friendly relationships is to say thank you to everybody for everything. Somebody makes a nice comment, you say thank you. Somebody makes a mean comment, you say thank you. You just thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And a trick that the first President Bush used was to write 50 thank you notes every night before going to bed. I can't do that, but I did write 5 thank you notes every night before going to bed and mail them out the next day. So the more you thank people, the more they will want to take your next call.
Jeff, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. Jancy, it's the little things sometimes that can help build these connections.
Yes, and this leads into one of our exercises, which is to send a note of thanks to somebody who made a difference in your life. And it can be hard to be vulnerable when you thank them, but, you know, it can make their day or their week or their month. I remember looking at a report card for my fourth grade class, and my teacher, Mrs. Manley, when I was growing up in Cleveland, she said, in the comments, Jancy can really write. I think she's going to be a writer one day. And I can remember being in fourth grade and thinking, wait, what? You can be a writer? You know, I didn't even know you could be one. My dad was a JCPenney manager, and she put it in my head. So I remember thinking, wait, is she still around? And she was. She's still with us. I wrote her a letter, and she has become my grandmother. I lost both of my grandmothers, and she didn't have any children. And now we write back and forth. I sent her flowers for her 90th birthday. I called her on New Year's Day. I owe her another call, actually. And that came from one letter. She sent me a letter immediately back. And you just don't know where it can lead. And it's really nice. And so, yeah, that was one exercise. And also, if you have a partner in your life, one of the exercises is to write down 10 different things that you like that your partner has done for you. Not qualities, not like, oh, you're cute or whatever, but you've done this for me, you've done this for me, things you appreciate. And I remember doing this for a couples therapist. And one of the things that I wrote for my husband, Tom, who went to school in Wisconsin, you painted my parents' house last summer. And then I thought, wait, you painted my parents' house last summer? Like, this blew by me? He was up on a rickety ladder in the heat near a wasp's nest every weekend for a long time. And like, you know, in the rush of daily life, you don't think about that. I started to cry. And so it's really an unusual exercise to read it aloud to your partner and to make eye contact, but he never forgot it. I never forgot it. And so that's one of the exercises as well. And it all goes back to what the caller said about gratitude, right? And you think it, but sometimes you don't voice it or write it down or email or text. And it's better to do a eulogy for somebody when they're alive, right? Rather than after they've gone.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jancy Dunn from the New York Times, her 7-day happiness challenge looks at ways to build better relationships. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Now, here's another, it seems like a small thing, small talk with strangers. Now, some people hate small talk. I like it. I feel like I'm not very good at it or confident with it. Really, we can get benefits from just that little bit of small talk with somebody we don't really know?
Think about when you've talk to somebody random on like a plane, and you, maybe you don't even learn their name or anything, but you have some sort of exchange that stays with you. I can think of conversations I've had with people on planes from years ago, and they still made an impact. And it doesn't need to be deep. You don't even need to know the person for it to stick with you. And even, you know, when you go to the grocery store or something and you have a nice exchange with somebody, you have that little kind of glow of well-being afterwards where you're like, ah, you know, it's even when someone lets you in traffic, that like there's something about a random connection that gives you real happiness. And so, but we do understand that it can be really difficult for people. Not everybody's a small talk person, you know, as you say, it's you don't even do it sometimes. And so we just gave a few easy ways to get started. And also people are rightly afraid of rejection. I mean, even for the exercise, I was making small talk with people, and sometimes people would edge away because they were afraid I was trying to sell them something, or I was going to pull out a pamphlet or something. So it doesn't always hit. But when they're rejecting you, when they're edging away, they don't know you. They're not rejecting you. They don't know you. And I kept trying to tell myself that, and we told readers that. So an easy way to strike up a conversation is always, you know, if someone has a cute kid or a baby or a dog, you can't go wrong. I always will say, you know, what's it like that no one makes, you know, to the person who is the parent, you know, what's it like that no one makes eye contact with you ever again because your kid is so cute? And then they're like, or if you're talking about a dog, is this dog always this well-behaved? People, then they inevitably will say, oh no, you know, he definitely keeps me, you know, hopping. I always give this example. It's in the article. Mm-hmm. I was walking around my neighborhood, and there's a lady whose dog, her dachshund, always barks at me, and it drove me insane. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to take this challenge, and I'm going to go talk to this lady. So I said, how can I get your dog to like me? He just doesn't seem to like me. And she said, oh, Petey doesn't like it when people wear hats. And I said, excuse me? Petey gets upset and he barks, and I can't tell everyone in the neighborhood that, because then I would never go anywhere. So yeah, winters are tough for Petey because everyone has hats on. And I thought, okay, number one, I love the name Petey. Number two, I love your dog. And when I see Petey now, I quickly rip off my hat so that Petey won't get tense and bark. And it's almost like a little game. So my point is that my neighborhood is friendlier now because I can't wait to see Petey coming. And now I have a connection with the woman that I was talking to. And it's almost selfish because it's friendlier for you too. It makes, you know, your kind of mobile world friendlier as you move through it.
In our last minute or so, I understand you've heard back from people now who have tried the 7-day happiness challenge. What kind of feedback are you getting?
Oh my goodness. We would read through the comments and we would be in tears. And I've been interacting with some of the readers as well. We had one person who said, oh, I've been estranged from my brother for 30 years. And I texted him. I found his text number and I asked him, do you want to just talk for 8 minutes? And the brother said yes. And they talked for the first time. And I mean, you just can't, you know, there was someone else whose wife had died. And the person didn't want to leave the house. And, you know, they'd been together for 32 years and they were taking some of the challenges just so they could build up their connections again and not feel so alone. And even what is touching is people who have difficulty making small talk, and they would say, okay, today I went up to the receptionist at the place where I teach ballroom dancing. This was one lady. And I talked to the receptionist and it was very hard for me, but I did it, you know, and we would all cheer each other on because it can be so difficult for people, and we do understand that. So there's been tons of stories like that, and it just reinforces that people are hungry for connection.
Jancy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Oh, a pleasure to be here.
That's Jancy Dunn, columnist for The Well at the New York Times. She talked to us about her recent series, The 7-Day Happiness Challenge. We've got a link to that up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to talk to the author of the new cookbook, Salad Freak. And you can share your favorite salads to make and eat on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.